Welcome to our Day 10 preview from the 2018 US Open. I'm Pete Hodges with Ravi Uber. A special welcome to tennis fans around the world listening in on Courtside, the official podcast of the US Open. It's been a spectacular Day 9, just as it was Day 8. What are we going to get Day 10? I mean, it's been just a phenomenal tournament, really, from start to finish. So many stories to look at. But we're going to start with the order of play. And first up on Ash, it's Naomi Osaka against Lucia Cyrenko. I suppose, Ravi, you're going to go with Naomi Osaka because she's the bigger ball striker, the bigger hitter. And Cyrenko also looked a little injured. But can you give any hope to those Ukrainian fans perhaps listening in?
Yeah, I can. I mean, Cyrenko is a very, very good player coming into this, a top 40 player, just missed out on a seeding, picked up her first top 10 win in a while in Cincinnati, beating Garbiñe Muguruza, who, okay, may have been undercooked, but still that was big for Cyrenko because she hadn't had a top 10 win for 3 years since 2015. Loves playing on North American hard courts where she's posted all of her top 10 wins and thinks she does well, competes well. Very, very good backhand. She's worked on the forehand over the years. Now says it's her favorite shot. And also she's in the top 10 when it comes to return games won. So there's a lot that she brings to the court. I think for a player like Cyrenko, you have to beat her. It's pretty rare that she'll beat herself. But in this situation with Osaka winning Indian Wells, the confidence she would have gained by also getting to a first Grand Slam quarterfinal, she has much more firepower. But she's also reined it in, so has that nice mix of controlled aggression and playing really good tennis.
Yeah, that was actually the question I was going to ask you in terms of, do you think the pressure will get to her playing in her first quarterfinal? And also, when she beat Sabalenka, we saw her do an Andy Murray, so to speak, as in sit on the court in tears, just with the joy of getting through to the last eight of a slam. Is that a good thing or a bad thing moving forward, seeing that emotion pour out of her?
Well, it's always nice to see that from a player because it shows how much it means to them. That's always great. We like seeing that from athletes. And I think part of that stems from what she said afterwards. She said that, you know, she'd been getting to third round at majors pretty regularly, but the question was always coming, when are you going to translate that into a Grand Slam quarterfinal? And so she's felt that pressure going in, and she talked going into the U.S. Open, it was last week, week and a half ago, that, you know, she wasn't really feeling great. She put something out on social media. She felt a bit down, but then recovered after a couple of days and said, yep, roaring, ready to go for the U.S. Open, and was looking forward to a good fortnight. And that's what happened in that match against Sabalenka, two of the brightest young stars in the women's game and in all of tennis, in fact. So it was a great contest. And again, she was, I think, expected to do this, but now that she has done this, maybe it's going to free her up a little bit and say, okay, I've got there now, and we can kick on from that.
It's a very interesting dynamic, though, to be in that situation. First ever Grand Slam quarterfinal, and you're the favourite, so it'll be fascinating to watch. As I say that, the first match on the Arthur Ashe Stadium at midday. That will then be followed by Marin Cilic against Kei Nishikori. This, of course, a repeat of the former final here a few years ago between the same two. And on that occasion, it was Cilic who came out on top in straight sets. But of course, Nishikori had been through a bruising passage of long matches to get to that final. Not so this time around. He's looking very good, the Japanese player. Tough one to call this, so who are you edging towards?
I'm edging with Cilic. He leads in terms of their Grand Slams. Head-to-head, he has the better record, 3-1 in majors, even though Kay leads overall marginally 8-6. They've had a couple of battles at the U.S. Open, so we talk about that 2014 final, which was a win for Cilic, but the first time they met at the U.S. Open, it was a five-hour duel, a real epic that was won by Kay in that particular day. Listen, Cilic, even though we're talking about conditions that are a little bit slower, the slower hard court, he's talked about the balls being heavier, he still has the propensity to win, I think, 3 points on his serve. And also one thing he'll be able to do is go after the Nishikori serve. Nishikori doesn't necessarily have the biggest serve around, and that's something he was able to do in that 2014 final, although it should be mentioned that Kay was saying, reflecting on that, that, you know, he was very nervous that day when he stepped out onto the court. And as you said, Pete, he's pretty much gone through unscathed. Nishikori, he's lost the one set against was it against Diego Schwartzman, and it was a very, very good matchup to watch. But I just give the edge to Cilic. I still think even in these conditions, he has the ability to hit through Nishikori.
Yeah, it should be very, very interesting. And Cilic, of course, was helped out by that quick fire win over David Goffin, showing that he can recover from that epic against Alex de Minaur. Meanwhile, in the night session tomorrow, it will be a 7 p.m. start. Carlos Suarez Navarro against Madison Keys. It's an absorbing contest to watch. And Keys has been talking about the pressure she finds on herself, of course, having been a finalist here last year.
I don't think it's pressure on the court. I think there's too many other things going on to be concerned about that. But I think the biggest thing is, you know, just playing through nerves and playing through wanting to do well. And you just keep your feet moving and go for your shots.
Keeping your feet moving and going for your shots. And I'm sure we're going to see that from Keys. It's a fascinating matchup, though, isn't it, in terms of contrasting styles. Suarez Navarro, more of a counterpuncher, defensive player, can really vary the way she plays, whereas we almost know what Keys is going to do. So first of all, how is Suarez Navarro going to set up against Keys?
Well, she's not going to change her tactic. The way she plays is to use those angles to change the pace of the ball. She'll have to get a good percentage of first serves in play because she doesn't want Keys the ability to really tee off on those second serves. So that's going to be important for her. You look at their head-to-head, Pete, it's 3-love to Keys, but all three of them have been three setters. And in fact, they had a third set tiebreak in Birmingham 2016, also a very tight one at the Olympics. Suarez Navarro going into this one with the proverbial no pressure at all, because everybody expects Keys to win this. But Suarez Navarro will be so high on confidence after beating Maria Sharapova on her birthday. Of course, she had faced the likes of Venus and Serena in the past on her birthday at the U.S. Open. And she was able to get over the finish line, which I think for her was so, so big. Because we have seen in the past, sometimes when she's in big matches, she has opportunities, she has leads, just unable to close the door. And even though I think that Sharapova really helped her out at the end of both sets, she's not going to be thinking about that, Suarez Navarro. She'll be thinking about, okay, I've done it. I've beaten a massive, massive player at a Grand Slam in Sharapova, so she'll be going in confident, no doubt.
You say that, though. This is her second quarterfinal here at the US Open. Of course, the last time she was in the last eight here, didn't pick up a game. Lost 6-love to Serena Williams. So will that be in the back of the mind anywhere?
I don't think so. I think that if she was taking on Serena again, then that would be in the back of her mind. But no, I think because she's taking on a different opponent, she'll be thinking about the head-to-head she has with Keys and the fact that all three of their matches have been pretty close. I mean, she's been on the big stage before, right? She's won a big title in Doha. She made the final in Miami in 2015. And the only reason she was outside the top 20 last year in terms of the year-end finish was because early part of the year she had a shoulder problem that was made for a stop-start campaign the first 2-3 months of the season. So always a very consistent player and like Keys, very well liked.
Yes indeed. To Suarez Navarro, you never hear a bad word about her. But that is the first matchup of the evening session. That is again then followed by Novak Djokovic against John Millman. Everyone's asking the same question. Can he do it again? Well, he's been speaking and he's been sounding pretty confident, like he can.
I always was of the opinion that I was, you know, in the fourth round for a reason. I've never played anyone's reputation. That's been a constant with me for, you know, ever since I've played the game. Because I think if you do that, then you start behind the eight ball straight away.
So you know the question that's coming your way here, Ravi, as in, can he do it again? Before you answer it and write him off, let's just remember what we've seen the last couple of nights and the last couple of days here and what makes this sport so enjoyable to watch. Yep. And how it is just down to one person's mind, and if they're a little ill and they're playing in strange conditions like we've had for the last few days, anything can happen. But other than anything can happen, do you see any format or way he's got to play to be able to get the better of Novak Djokovic?
Well, he only knows one way to play, and that's to patrol the baseline, get a lot of balls back, take his opportunity in rallies when he gets a bit of the shorter ball. Sometimes he goes forward, but generally he likes to stay at the back. He doesn't necessarily have the biggest serve. He likes to put that in to start the point. He's not going to change the way he plays. The one thing he might do is try and go earlier in rallies and attack when he has the chance. By attack, I mean go for the big shots. Because if he just trades with Djokovic, it's not going to really work out for him. But then again, he doesn't really have a plan B.
As far as Djokovic is concerned, though, as in, we've just seen Nadal win an epic, a long epic, nearly 5 hours. We've seen Roger Federer go out. As in, it's all pointing his way. I mean, it's only 2-3 months removed from when he was having all sorts of troubles. And all of a sudden now, it feels like he is the strong favourite here.
Yep.
Do you expect that? I mean, in the past, you feel he's dealt with that completely fine. But will that feel a little odd in terms of how quickly it's switched?
Yeah, a good question. I think I'll say no, and I'll say that for a couple of reasons. Number one, he just won Wimbledon, so I think he's got the winning feeling back, and that winning feeling brings him back to those good old days when he was dominating men's tennis. And I think he'll also reflect and think about those days and remember what it was like to do that. I think the muscle memory, if you want to call it that, the brain memory in this case, will always be there for him. And he is the heavy favorite now. The thing is, one thing I would say is that he had that draining one. It wasn't a long match, but in the heat against João Sousa yesterday, it took a lot out of him. The doctor was out. He was getting his blood pressure checked. He also had a draining one in the first week, second round against Martin Fucsovics, when he looked really out of sorts, again, in the mega, mega heat. And a part of me says, okay, well, you know what? It's going to be a night match. The heat is going to be less. It's still going to be sticky, by the way. Not as bad as it was. But then there's the cumulative effect of playing matches in those steamy conditions. Is that going to affect him against Milman? Personally, I would think not. And then if he gets through that, we're looking at much gentler conditions over the last 3 days. So it would take a lot, I think, for Phil Milman to come through and win this match. Just the matchup is not there for him. They actually met on the grass when Djokovic started his grass court campaign in Queens. 6-2, 6-1 for Djokovic. He was untroubled, won 92% of his first serve points. So he'll be comfortable with that matchup. We hope it's going to be a good matchup. And the one thing we are guaranteed is that Milman is going to give 150%.
He is indeed, and he'll have a lot of crowd support as well after that phenomenal win over Roger Federer, as will Djokovic, though, as he always does, being a great champion here that he is. Well, that is our Day 10 preview for Ravi Uber. I'm Pete Hodges. Thanks for listening. Join us for complete live coverage every day on US Open Radio, presented by American Express. You can find us on usopen.org or the US Open app.
This year on Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open, we're going behind the scenes. We're meeting the personalities that are a part of this tournament that make it come alive. And today, I'm getting the honor to sit alongside a journalist that has covered this event now 40 years. That's every year here at the NTC as we know it. Cindy Schmerler, this place has changed just a little bit since 1979, right?
Nick, well, first of all, I'm thrilled that you spelled my name correctly because my name has been butchered in print.
Come on,
it's
I had to.
It's been butchered
I had
on the air.
It.
It's been. I've heard Cindy Schmerier. I've heard Cindy Schmeller. I've heard them all. So I'm thrilled. Thank you for that. Yes, this place has changed. And by the way, I was like 6 years old when I did my first U.S. Open. So
yeah, of course,
absolutely,
of course
first grade. First grade. I will tell you that when we first started covering the U.S. Open over on Louis Armstrong Stadium, the press box, which really was a box, it was a long box that covered the end of the court, and we were scrunched together at tables that we all shared, and on either end was an open area, and Bud Collins, my dear friend, the great Bud Collins, would come out, and he had this kid that he knew, and he'd bring out these picnic lunches, and we'd sit out there and have picnic lunch every day. It was completely awesome. Different than it would. There was no media dining room then. There was also only one bathroom, and it was not for women. So there were only three women in the press room then: Leslie Visser, myself, and I'm sure there was one other, two others, and probably Sandy Harwit. And we would go down, and we would have to rumble down all the staircases just to get to the restroom. But the highlight of the time was when there was actually a tornado in the park, and Bud screamed out. We could see it sort of swirling, and the entire press box started to shake. And I couldn't decide whether I should run down the stairs and risk this press box falling on top of me, because that wasn't going to be a fun way to die, or to just stay there. And Bud, the great Bud, looks out and screams, "What a boon for the Columbia School of Journalism." He figured they'd have to replace the entire press corps. This place is completely different now. Our facilities are magnificent, both on Arthur Ashe Stadium and on Louis Armstrong and on the grandstand. I've broadcast now from Court 17, the grandstand. I love them both because you feel like you are literally next to the players.
Yeah. I mean, the site has changed a lot, obviously, over the years. Now, we'll go, first off, great start, good stormy start with a tornado story weaving in Bud Collins. But what are you up to this year? You have a lot of different hats. You're staying very busy. We're getting you. Thank you during your lunch break.
Yeah, I'm going for all the mediums this year. I'm doing radio for American Express Radio. So I come back during ESPN's breaks of action, which is really fun because I get to wax poetic on what I always say, which is a wealth of useless information. And then I get to interview fans, and then we interview players. And each morning we have a guest on the show. This morning we had the great Hanna Madlikova, the 1985 champion. And it was fun to talk to her because her daughter Ellie is playing in the junior championships this year. So Hanna has gone through all derivatives. She's been a player, a coach, because she coached Jana Novotná, the great Jana Novotná. And now she's not coaching her own daughter. She's acting as a mother. And then I'm doing some writing for the New York Times, which is great fun. And then I write a little column called Courting Fame, which is introducing the fans to kids and players and people that they would not have known about each day in the program. So I'm very busy. I don't sleep a lot this week.
But over the years, I mean, I was reading actually on your LinkedIn. I mean, you've worked for USA Today and ESPN, and way back when it was on USA Network, when I was a kid, I remember watching the US Open on USA.
Yep, my very first broadcasting assignment, which just doesn't happen today, but Barbara Travers from USA Network heard my voice on the phone and said, I kind of like your voice. Have you ever done TV? I said, no. And she said, okay, come on, you can come for the U.S. Open. And we were a team of four. It was Tim Ryan and Barry McKay, the late, great Barry McKay, and Mary Carrillo and myself. And they called us Strictly Cable because we were not network caliber, but we had a great time and we worked very hard. And I was the courtside reporter. And Nick, back then, when I interviewed players on courtside, as I know you've done so many times in your career, you're terrific at that now. We had to interview the losers. So I had to stand courtside. And when Jennifer Capriati lost to Monica Seles, I had to stand there as a very tearful Jennifer came over. And I had to say, I'm really sorry. What do you think? By, you know, shoving a microphone in her face. Wow. And it was required of the players. And nobody blanched at it. And they just said how they felt. We had a lot of tears. We had a lot of anger. And nobody protected the players the way they do now. So that's kind of the way it was.
Okay, so you talk about that shift, obviously, that match you mentioned, 1991 semifinal, Capriati-Seles. But what are, I mean, you know, now in the age of Twitter and Instagram and the internet, I mean, so much has changed about the way that we, you know, people are on their phones all day on the app, the US Open app, which is great, by the way. But what's changed as far as the job goes? Because you've seen it, Cindy, in so many different iterations.
I would say what makes it harder as a reporter to do your job is that the players are saying so much themselves. They're going on Twitter. They're putting out Insta stories. They're going on Facebook. They're telling their own tale. And so when you think you can break a story, it's hard. They've already broken it. They don't want you to tell the story. They want to take ownership of it themselves. So if somebody isn't feeling well, they're going to go on and say that. And that makes it a little bit trickier. You know, we have to be a little bit more creative about the way we go about things. Players are far more protected than they ever were. You know, you see the agents and the entourages. And I've been known to say to a player, you know, don't walk by. You've known me for 15 years. You've known me for 40 years. Don't do that. I've known Venus and Serena since they were 9 and 10. I was very fortunate. Arthur Ashe took me to Philadelphia, to the Arthur Ashe Youth Center, and they were doing an exhibition when they were just kids. It was right after Arthur announced that he had AIDS, shortly before he passed away. And he said, I want you to see these two players. And so they were kids, and Venus was as gangly and Gumby-like as she is now, but a little less polished. And they were fun to watch. And Serena just wanted whatever Venus wanted. And so there they were, you know, as little kids. And so they've grown up with me watching them. And players make it, you know, sometimes they make it easy and sometimes they make it hard. I was very fortunate. John Isner and Kevin Anderson, when they played in the final of the NCAA team championships in Athens, Georgia, I was broadcasting for ESPN.
Wow.
And I remember that match very vividly because the crowd was manic, and chief among them was Isner's brother, Jordan, who was a little bit inebriated in the stands and screaming so loud that we had to look at him and say, Jordan, I think you're embarrassing your parents right now. And then, sure enough, they show up at Wimbledon this year and they play that extraordinary semifinals. So it's been an interesting run. I feel incredibly privileged. I always say that sure, this sure beats working for a living, but I love what I do.
Yeah, no, I wanted to ask you about that later, but let's go there right now. The passion. I mean, obviously you have it. It lives in your blood. Why keep coming back, or what's sort of the best part of doing what you get to do?
You know what? First of all, I love a good story. I will have people every single day say, who's your favorite player? I said, I've never had a favorite player. I have people who are easier to work with. I have people who are more difficult. I've never found John McEnroe to be very easy to work with. Yvonne Lendl, I have no problem saying to, oh, knock it off already. And he will. And he'll behave and he'll send, you know, he will answer every single time you ask him a question or you call. I root for the story. And that's what's the most important part. And the thing about tennis is every single athlete has a story. It's just a little tricky to find them sometimes. And when you dig down and you learn about a Savastova and you learn that she hated the game and she left, and then when she came back and she called her mother and said, I'm in the quarterfinals back in 2015, her mother is sobbing on the other end of the phone. And there are so many compelling tales to tell, because in the end, Virginia Wade said something to me the other day. Virginia, of course, the first champion here 50 years ago in 1968. Virginia said, you know, people forget, we're human. We're just people. They're people who do something at a very high level, but that doesn't make them any different than you or than me or than your friends and my kids or anything else.
Hmm. Yeah, poetic here on the podcast. Speaking of stories, you started us off with a tornado, which I loved, but this morning you showed me a picture of your, I think it was your desk or your badge from 1979. Let close out with, I don't know, one or two other stories, or close us out being nostalgic, because not only are we celebrating 50 years of the U.S. Open itself, the Open era, but we are 40 years anniversary of this very NTC, the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center.
Yeah, I came in actually the second year in 1979. The center opened in 1978. My mother took me to Forest Hills in 1977, and I remember walking around, and I did see Billie Jean. I didn't meet her. I was too afraid. She had just lost to Julie Heldman, and she had actually said to Julie, she was sick, and she had actually said to Julie, if you want the match, you can have it, and she walked off court. And I did get Julie Heldman's autograph, and of course, a year later, I was working for her mother, Gladys, who had just sold World Tennis Magazine, and I was summer interning there, and that was the greatest experience I ever had, because working at World Tennis was all-encompassing, and people like Susan Baker Adams and Steve Flink and Neil Amder and a host of characters, many of whom are still around the game or still around sports, but they became a family. And when you have an environment like that, and everybody in that room was passionate about tennis, everybody cared about it. We would come to the U.S. Open, and back then they would say, here, who needs tickets for their friends and family? And we would literally just sort of go around, and everybody loved the game. Mm. So when we came here, it was a magnificent sight to behold. Nobody expected Slew Hester, who was the president of the USTA, to come up with a venue like this. And he did, and he made it magical for everybody. And I feel like over those 40 years, there have been so many stories. There was a time where Hanna Matlakova lost after she had won the championship. The next year, she lost early. And she didn't want to greet the media. So she ran away. And back then, you really could sort of run after a player. And they didn't have handlers moving them into the locker rooms, and into the, you know, the air conditioning, and away from the fans and away from the press. So Hanna ran by herself. And about six of us ran after her. Except that I looked around, and suddenly Hanna had ducked into an outside restroom. And I was the only woman. So I looked up and I said, they're not going into the ladies' restroom. I guess I am. So I came out and I literally confronted Hanna, who was in the stall, and I said, just give me a quote. You know, tell me what you were thinking. Hanna gave me the quote. I came out, and some people called me the pool reporter. Others called me the Lou reporter. And just moments like that over the years.
Yeah.
Really, they're the ones that keep me coming back. I mean, I love everybody I work with. I've had tremendous teams, including the American Express Radio Group this year and the New York Times crew, and everybody in the press room. When you come back in here, Nick, and you know this as well as I do, you walk into the press room on the first day of the tournament, and it feels like the first day of school. It's kindergarten all over again, and everybody is kind of dressed in their finest for those first couple of days, and they just want to let everybody know that all is well in their lives, and another year has come and gone, and aren't we lucky to be back here doing what we love?
Well, thank you for sharing some of your stories with us here on Courtside. And also, we've been lucky enough to have Steve Flink as part of the podcast all year long, which has been fantastic. So thank you.
Thank you, Nick. It's always fun to be with you.
We're very happy on this podcast to welcome Owen Davidson, the Hall of Famer from Australia, who won the Mixed Doubles Grand Slam in 1967, winning it with Billie Jean King after having played the first of those events with Leslie Turner. But Owen, your greatest, one of your greatest claims to fame, and something I know you're very proud of, is you played in the very first match ever of the Open era, April 22, 1968, at the British Hard Court Championships in Bournemouth. Can you explain the circumstances behind that, how you came to play the first match ever in the Open era?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of circumstances actually behind it. I'd been talking to the All England Club for a while, and after I got to the semi-finals at Wimbledon in 66, they interviewed me about the job at the All England Club.
Right.
And I was talking to Mr. Herman David and to Major David Mills, and then after I decided I was going to turn pro and be the All England Club professional, which was a big decision in those days. So after I won Wimbledon in 67, I think Lee and I won the mixed, I kind of turned around on the center court and looked at a little bit of grass and figured that'd be the last time I'd ever be back there. I went to Britain and became the All England Club coach. I guess it was about October or November of 67, which was a huge decision because that was the end of tennis as far as I was concerned, amateur tennis. And we used to do, in those days, Steve, we used to do the winter training, as you well know, because you remember, at Queen's Club.
Yes, I was.
We did all our winter training at Queen's Club in those days. And in the middle of winter, I obviously spent a lot of time talking to Major Mills and Mr. Herman David because I actually worked for them. By then, I worked for them. In those days, the All England Club player at Wimbledon was employed by Wimbledon and then you were contracted out to the LTA. And I came out of the indoor courts one day in November, October, and Mr. David, there was a lot of people there, a huge number of people there had been at the LTA meeting. And Herman walked up to me and he said, "Oh, I just want you to know that no matter what happens, we're going open next year. We just made the decision and we're going open next year," which once again, I didn't think it would affect me a whole lot, although now, of course, I realize how much it affected me. And so anyway, so the first tournament, as you said, was Bournemouth. And I asked the LTA if I had permission to play because I had to ask them. And they said, "Absolutely no problem. Of course you can play." So I entered Bournemouth. And then the interesting thing on the day, for those that have never been to Bournemouth, which I'm sure is probably a lot of people, there was a clubhouse court right up where the clubhouse was. And then the center court is kind of like the situation at Forest Hills these days. Center court was like 500 yards all the way down the walkway where you had to walk before you got to the center court. And on center court was scheduled Fred Stolle and a guy by the name of Peter Curtis, who was on the British Davis Cup team.
Yep, remember him well. He ended up marrying Marianne Eisel, is that correct?
He did. Yep. He did, amongst others. And I was scheduled to play John Clifton, who was also on the Davis Cup team, on the grandstand court. And as it turned out, it rained like it always did at Bournemouth. The clubhouse court dried way, way quicker than the center court. Consequently, John Clifton and I went on a long time before the center court was ready and played the first match in open tennis, yeah.
And Owen, were you aware of the significance of that? I mean, it was a big deal. Obviously, Herman David had told you of his and what was going to unfold, but nevertheless, this was a big moment. And did it dawn on you at that point of where this was all going and how important it all was and that you were being such a part of it and playing in the first match?
No idea. Just went on the court because he had to go on the clubhouse court to play John. No, totally, totally, totally unaware.
And did you feel a lot of pressure playing John and being the pro, and here were the pros and amateurs playing in the same tournaments for the first time? That must have been something of a burden, or was it not?
If I'd have been in competition still, playing John Clifton, a great guy, we would have probably considered it not too difficult a match. But having been the pro for 5 or 6 months by then, you know, you don't play matches, you're just practicing with the team. The whole idea was practicing was to make them better, not you. So, yeah, so then there was a bit of pressure because now all of a sudden the pupil had the chance to beat the teacher.
So then, Owen, you went on to the quarters and lost to Rosewall. And do you remember the atmosphere as that tournament unfolded and eventually ended up with Rosewall beating Labor in the finals how everybody felt about this inaugural event taking place when it did?
Somebody asked me that the other day, and I had no idea who I'd lost to. None. But then they mentioned to me that I'd lost to Rosewall in the quarters. I do very well remember watching the final between Ken and Rod, and it was the usual Labor Rose War match, and it was a great match to watch, and everybody loved it. But, you know, honestly, I think anybody that told you then that they knew where all this was going, I think they'd be lying.
Interesting.
I don't think anyone, even Labor and Rose War, as much as they knew that it was great and they were in the first open final, I don't think any of us really knew where it was all going to go. For guys of my age, Australian guys especially of my age, the thrill of walking into Bournemouth and knowing that Ken Rosewall and Rod Laver were going to be there was just something you couldn't have even imagined. But the biggest memory I have of it all, because Rod and Ken were friends, still are friends, and played against them many, 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 many times, and the biggest memory I have of it all to this day is walking into that club and seeing Pancho Gonzalez in the same locker room playing in the same tournament. Deep down, you always had a feeling, as an Australian guy like Newcomb and Roach and myself, probably Stiley, somewhere along the line you may see Rod and Ken and those guys again on the other side of a net. But to see the image of Pancho Gonzalez, that was something I'll never forget. And even now, when I think of Bournemouth, I think of playing John Clifton, obviously, walking onto that court. And I think, you know, obviously Rod and Ken playing the final, et cetera, et cetera. But the memory still floods into my head of seeing Pancho Gonzalez at the same event we were all playing at. It was pretty amazing.
Owen, do you have any recollection of what you made? I think that Kenny might have made £1,000 for winning it. What did you make from reaching the quarters?
Not a clue, Steve. Not any idea. I mean, it's amazing. No idea.
That's interesting. Now, Owen,
it's better than I'd made before. I knew that.
Yeah, of course. Let's go back to the year before briefly and talk about what did you set out in 67? It started with Leslie Turner, and then you won the last three with Billie Jean, and you're one. There have only been two mixed doubles Grand Slams because Ken Fletcher won it with
right.
Margaret Smith. But
right.
Was that something that unfolded, or was it something that you as an outstanding doubles player thought that you could accomplish when the year began?
Once again, Steve, in those days, we didn't count all the statistics like they do these days. And I just happened to play mixed with Leslie in Australia, and we won. And there was a lot of circumstances around me getting together with Billie Jean in Paris, and we won. And then we decided to play Wimbledon, and we won. And then we played together in the U.S. Open, or whatever it was called in those days.
Right.
And once again, Steve, I had no idea that I was playing for the Grand Slam. It was the late Bud Collins.
Right, right.
Who lived in Boston in those days, as you know,
mm-hmm.
came up to me before that match, and I think we played Smith and Casals.
Yes, you did.
I'm not positive.
You did.
Okay.
You did.
And he came up to me and he said, you know, you realize, Davo, that you've got a chance of winning the Grand Slam. Billie Jean does not. But you do, and I, you know, to be honest with you, that was the very, very first time I even thought about it.
So Bud said that to you before the finals, or?
Yeah, before. That was very nice of him, wasn't it? Scared the hell out of me.
I was going to say you were much better off not hearing. But it's interesting, Owen. I looked back and I see that you had good wins in the finals of all those majors. Beat Judy with Leslie. You beat Judy Tegart and Tony Roach.
Right.
And then you went over Ann Hayden Jones and Jan Tyriak at the French, and you beat Maria Bueno and Ken Fletcher at Wimbledon.
Right.
And finally, as you said, Rosie and Stan at the U.S. Those are all
right.
Pretty distinguished teams. I mean, did you feel like there were more people taking the mix seriously at that time? As you look back, those were very good wins.
Well, Steve, of all people, you would know, and Billie Jean and I talk about it often. She brings it up often because we still talk quite a lot. In those days, almost everybody played every event. So if you look back at the Wimbledon results earlier than that, you'll find Rod Laver won the Wimbledon mixed. You'll find Fred Stolle won it many times. You'll find all the great players played it. And when Billie Jean, I mean, the toughest team by far for us, Billie Jean and I, to play was Margaret Smith Court and Marty Reeson. And everybody, there were definitely some easy first rounds, because there wasn't the depth in tennis that there is these days. But once you got through to the quarters, you know, you were playing teams like, as you say, Francois Durr and Tony Roach, or Olga Moritzova and Alex Metrovelli, who lost in the final at Wimbledon. One of the years Billy and I won, we played Kotas and Navratilova in the quarterfinals.
Mm.
Navratilova was very young then. But, I mean, yeah, we played a lot of Not early in the tournament. Early in the tournament, mostly the matches were not so difficult. You're right.
Oh, and did it sink into you? Bud, of course, had put that thought in your head before the finals against Rosie and Stan. Then you go out, win the title comfortably, and now you've pulled off all four for a Grand Slam. At that point, did it sink into you in a more substantial way?
Well, I'm almost sure that Bud probably said something afterwards, and I obviously thought about it. It wasn't like I didn't. And I thought, oh, that's pretty good. I want, you know, the Grand Slam because, I mean, yeah, I obviously gave it some thought and thought how good it was and very pleased and all that sort of stuff. And then went on to whatever was the next tournament. And I'm not belittling it at all. It's just the way we were in those days. It wasn't that long after that. One friend of mine said to me, I saw your name in the Guinness Book of Records. And I said, the Guinness Book of Records? What are you talking about? And that's when they told me, and I think it's still there, was that the first match in open tennis against John Clifton and then winning the Grand Slam in mixed doubles. Apparently they had it in the Guinness Book of Records, yeah.
Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. Thank you for listening all year to our celebration of 50 years of the U.S. Open.